Let's talk about the future of news.
I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news.
The state of journalism today.
Telling both sides of a controversial story.
I think you must be unbiased.
It's honesty, fairness, truth.
That is our job. That is our job. That is our job. That is our job.
Welcome once again to the Iron Man in Stockholm podcast. I am, as always, Philip O'Connor. One of the things I've noticed as I've travelled around the world is exactly how little people outside of Northern Ireland know about it. And in that, I'm including pretty much all of those on the southern part of the island as well. There's little or no understanding of a country with a history that is violent, bloody and complicated, and where things cannot really be seen through the normal prisms of politics, culture or society as we know them. For years, the story of the region has been produced by big media organisations, often using crews and correspondents flown in for that specific purpose. But recently, films have begun to emerge that are being made by people who have lived there all their lives. Needless to say, their stories look a lot different, and the stories behind those stories are also complex. Unquiet Graves is a documentary made by Sean Murray about the Glenan Gang, which essentially was a collection of sectarian murderers that terrorised the Catholic population in Northern Ireland. They carried out dozens and dozens of murders and attacks over approximately 8 years. It's a challenging piece of work. It's informative, emotional, and it's pretty hard to watch. You might think that such a story would be met by universal acclaim coming as it does after the peace process, but it hasn't. In fact, it's been anything but. After a recent showing on Irish state broadcaster RTE, Murray and many others in the film have been attacked by politicians and public figures who essentially describe the work as IRA propaganda. I spoke to him from his home in Belfast to find out his reaction to that response and also how he came to tell these stories. Sean, could I just ask you, before we start to talk about the film Unquiet Graves, could I ask you to tell me a little bit, you live in Belfast and you grew up in Belfast, can you tell me a little bit about the era you grew up in?
Well, I grew up in the '80s, which was here in West Belfast was a pretty violent period, as you well know. So, my political ideology, if you like, was shaped around where I'd come from. I come from an area which was maybe we could point to the genesis of the contemporary conflict in 1969. So, I'm from Clonard, and we're. In 1969, we had the area almost burnt to the ground by loyalist mobs and the RUC. So I was always aware of that when I had grown up. And because it's an interface area, Clonard is an interface area that backs onto the Shankill Road. And we have the large peace line, which is still there. And there was always this kind of strife growing up, you know, between and this wandering over the other, at the other side of that wall, you know. A lot of, you know, Protestant lads my age, I wouldn't have knew. The only contact I would have had would have been through rats. But I never would have known anyone, you know, until maybe my early 20s or late teens, actually, when I would have went to the raves, once the rave scene came in, you're starting to go to places where you'd find Protestants have been there, and the rest is history, you know.
When you talk about that kind of segregation, because the peace line, I always find that it's the least apt description I've ever heard of anything, really, you know. But if you played soccer or anything like that, you wouldn't have played against local clubs, you wouldn't have gone to the same schools, you wouldn't have hung out at the same street corners as Protestant lads at all.
No. So you know, the two iconic places, if you'd like, of divide, if we're talking even all over the north, would be the Shankill Road and the Falls Road. So Clonard is an area that is on the Falls Road. Mm. And of course, the Shankill Road's well known also. So both areas in themselves, and looking back on the conflict, would have been stereotyped, but they were areas where there would have been a lot of violence over the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s, you know. So that, as I say, you call it the peace wall, the divide wall, whatever you want to call it. That was a segregation that stood in the way of ever having contact with anyone. So it just was never there. We had our own. Obviously, we were segregated by religion through school and stuff like that there. But there was never any possibility of meeting anyone at the other side of that wall. It was just too violent during that period.
Were you curious about the people on the other side of the wall, or did you think you knew who they were already?
I was always very curious. I mean, the closest we would have came to with anyone was Rat. So we knew each other's names now, don't get me wrong. So there was this kind of repertoire that built up between people and Rats. We had to know on this person and that person, and they had to know on us. So this kind of mystery around, an aura around people growing up, that was always there, but never, no physical contact, you know. The closest we would have came with maybe been at about 8 foot.
Yeah.
Doing Rats and stuff like that, you know.
So that would be you lads on one side, and the Protestant lads from the Shankill on the other side, and maybe an RUC man in between, or was it everybody picking on the RUC? I'd sincerely doubt you were picking on them together.
Well, the RUC would have been usually starting with the Protestant lads.
True enough. So you wouldn't have had any friends, or you wouldn't really have had any contact. Did you feel you understood them at all, Sean? Did you feel like, I don't know, it's one of these things, and this is very much a post-1992 kind of vibe, like, you know, where, you know, since we started talking to and about people, that we learned a lot more about their culture and their history. Did you feel you knew anything about them? Did you understand the Protestant working class culture in Belfast, would you say?
No, I only understood it through the conflict. So they were always the enemy. So I never got the chance. It wasn't until later on in my years that I began to understand. And I began to understand it through my own family. And then I realized that my own family, my great-grandmother actually came from the Shankill Road and was a Protestant. So I became more curious about where she had come from. And of course, that trajectory that, I mean, I very easily could have been born on the other side of that wall, you know, a lot of it becomes absurd, particularly religiously. It becomes absurd because there's no difference. The people on the Shankill were just as poor as we were during the 70s and 80s and whatever else, you know. So it's once you begin to educate yourself and realize that a lot of the problems the people in the Shankill have, the people in the Falls Road have also. It's just the politics which has shaped us, that instills the differences in us, you know.
How did you get into filmmaking then?
Well, I get into film. It's always an interesting documentary, but I think if I look back on it, it really would have been 1988, and it was a couple of reasons for that. I had an uncle of mine that was killed in Gibraltar, Don McCann. He was one of the IRA volunteers that was killed in Gibraltar, and there was a documentary.
Death on the Rock, wasn't it?
Yeah, Death on the Rock by Roger Bolton, and it made a major impression on me because Margaret Thatcher had tried to stop the documentary. And it eventually won through and observed in October 1988. But what stood with me was the investigative journalism that went into that documentary. They went to Gibraltar right away. They were able to collate eyewitnesses before the establishment could get the hold. And a lot of the eyewitnesses went missing after that. And I always remember that Carmen Poeta, the things that had happened to Carmen Poeta, because she stood firm on what she had seen in Gibraltar.
Yeah.
So it was that period and that documentary. It was also a filmmaker during that period. It's kind of an underground filmmaker. It was a guy called Arthur McCaig. So he would have been from New Jersey. He lived in Paris, and he lived a lot of time in Belfast, also making documentaries. So these were documentaries where I'd seen my own community, their voices being marginalized voices, which you'd never have seen on the news or broadcast TV. You were seeing in these documentaries, which we had a head actually when British soldiers came to raid the houses. So these documentaries would have been in VHS tapes, recorded onto maybe cartoons or something, because the British Army found them, they would have called them propaganda films, you know. So Arthur McCaig made a big impression on me because it was an alternative, a counter-narrative to what was the official narrative around the conflict, and he was a mile ahead of his time.
In terms of style, in terms of how you learned to put these stories together. I mean, when you bring up Death on the Rock, it was such a powerful piece of television at the time. As people may know, Margaret Thatcher, as you said, she tried to stop it. There was court injunctions taken out. There was all sorts of the official secrets. Everything was kind of trotted out to stop that being broadcast as a matter of national security, as a matter of national embarrassment. But in terms of telling that story, like I said, that was a process of journalism. Was it the process of journalism that appealed to you, or was it visual storytelling as well? Because when I look at the work that you've done, the visual elements of it are not what one might expect from somebody who started in working class Belfast. Do you understand what I mean? You expect this of sort of art college people, of people who go to, you know, the Upper East Side, New York, and they go make films there. Where did you learn to do that? And who was the inspiration for that kind of storytelling?
Well, first of all, it was the storytelling with regards to Death on the Rock, because Death on the Rock was a current affairs documentary. Mm. It's a standard broadcast documentary, and I, for the most part, I wouldn't be a big fan of those types of documentaries. And you're right, I would veer more towards artistic documentaries, particularly world cinema and kind of underground documentaries, if you'd like. But artistically, I look to two other filmmakers around the world, you know, Patricio Guzman in Chile, Joshua Oppenheimer, and the work that he had done through the act of killing in Indonesia and stuff like that. So we look to other activist filmmakers around the world. For the most part, also activist filmmakers, because there's not that budget and there's not that financial support, they are not able to make the kind of documentaries that they'd like to make. So, you know, artistically, I find it in ordinary fictional filmmakers besides documentary, you know. But I would look towards Latin American cinema and stuff like that. Mm. There are a lot of great filmmakers out there, which aren't documentarians, but great filmmakers nonetheless. Mm.
One of the things, of course, that's quite specific to documentary making. Now, I've only ever worked in audio documentaries. I've never actually made a film documentary, but it's a similar process and there are similar questions that we have to ask ourselves. And the first one is a sort of a two-part question. One is, what gives us the right to make a documentary about these things? And the second thing is, what is our part in it? Are we going to be in front of the camera, behind the camera, in front of the microphone, behind the... Have we anything personally invested in it? So my question to you is, what did you feel gave you the right to tell the stories of those in Unquiet Graves?
The only thing that gave me the right to tell those stories was, first of all, meeting with the families and having the full support of the families. I would never have made that documentary unless I'd met the families and asked them, could I be a conduit for their stories? There's no way that I would ever make a documentary, particularly a documentary that affects people in such a traumatic way, unless I had the full support of those that were affected.
And because there are plenty of stories involved in Unquiet Graves, they're stories that are difficult to tell because of the fact that if you were doing the same thing in Indonesia and South America, as you just mentioned, you would have no personal relationship to the area, the people. But these were the stories of people that you knew. In some cases, it was members of your family who was affected. It was your neighbors that was affected. It was other people in Belfast and Northern Ireland. How aware were you during the process of making the film of that? And what did you do to sort of control the objectivity? Because you still have to bring an objective eye to what you're putting in front of the audience. Were you aware of that? Were you conscious of that when you were making the film?
Well, I never have to have an objective eye. That's a fallacy, a complete fallacy. And that's one thing that we need to speak about when we're talking about documentary. There's never, ever been an objective documentary. This is a fallacy that is wrong, particularly by broadcasters when they say that they're being objective in making a documentary film. Broadcasters aren't objective in any of the documentaries that they do. So there's always going to be this. What I do with my work is I try to attain the truth. And whether that's through the objective or subjective lens, it doesn't matter to me. I'm trying to get to the truth. And as long as you can adhere to trying to get to the truth, it doesn't matter.
Do you feel, though, because one of the things, and again, it goes back to the original question of what gives us the right to tell particular stories, that in some instances, and I'm absolutely not saying that this is the case now with Unquiet Graves, but sometimes we go into a story and we think to ourselves that we already know what the story is going to be, and we end up, you know, not choosing the facts, but it ends up somehow that we wind up at the point we expected to wind up at, rather than being open to it. Would you say that during the making of Unquiet Graves, were you sort of open to hearing new things? Was there anything in the process of making the film about the story of the Glenan gang that surprised you in a positive or a negative way? Anything that you didn't expect to feel when you were making that?
Well, just the scale of it. I mean, I had read Ancora Oliver's book, and the scale of the killings and those that were involved was something that the magnitude of it really struck me. But it wasn't until you're collecting those testimonies, you're bearing witness to those stories in such a personal level, that it really hits you. Mm. And you think you know it all, because I've had four members of my own extended family that were killed by the state also. And you think you know it all, but you don't. Until you sit down and you listen to someone who has lost a loved one in such a traumatic way, it just hits you every time. And particularly if we look at Margaret Campbell's testimony in Unquiet Graves, where she was brought to the ID parade, as well as seeing her husband been killed. I mean, I could watch that tonight and I could still be as affected by it tonight as I was the day that I conducted that interview with Margaret Campbell. It's just such a powerful testimony. And I think that what documentary is able to do, what Unquiet Graves was successful at doing is bringing those stories just to a wider audience and showing people what these people have went through, how they've been marginalized, how they've been ignored. And we have seen even this week that these families are still being ignored and these families are still being used as political capital for those in positions of power.
If we zoom out just a little bit, because there's a lot of listeners to this in Ireland and in Sweden and around the world who may not be aware of, I've told them what the film is about, but could you just explain to me in a couple of sentences what the Glenahan gang was and what they did? And then maybe we might talk about the specific case of Margaret Campbell's husband.
So the Glenahan gang was a gang that comprised membership of the British Army, police officers of the RUC, and a loyalist paramilitary group, the Ulster Volunteer Force. So you'd have had members, paramilitary members, who would also have been members of the police or members of the British Army, the UDR, which would have been the biggest regiment in the British Army at the time. So these were a gang that were centrally involved in attempting to exclude people from certain areas, for example. So you had a Catholic barman, Catholic shopkeepers who were doing well. All of a sudden, these people were killed. They tried to wipe out families. And we had seen by the research, which we'd seen in the film On Quiet Graves, we'd seen that people like the O'Dowds, families who were doing very well, they try to wipe these families out. Also attack on GA members and moderate nationalists, not Republicans, not hardline Republicans, but people who they thought might show some kind of support for the Irish Republican Army, the IRA.
So what you're saying is the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the Ulster Defence Regiment, you had people who were full-time soldiers, they were reservists, they were police officers, but then in their spare time, in inverted commas, they were part of the Glenahan gang. They were going around intimidating, murdering, threatening people.
That's correct. But we also seen that even while they were working, was seen an attack on the Rock Bar. While there were RUC police officers on duty at the time, they were attacking bars and trying to kill people in bars also.
You mentioned Margaret Campbell there, and that is one of the most powerful parts of the film. Could you just explain to me about the murder of her husband and what subsequently happened when she was brought to the police station to identify the man who killed him?
Well, Margaret Campbell's husband was a trade unionist, Pat Campbell. He was a man who was well respected in his local area in Bonbridge. He ran a local boxing club, and he was well got within, not only within the local community, but as a trade unionist within his job. So within his work, he would have had many Catholic friends and many Protestant friends. So people like that were always a target. So what had happened one night was that two gunmen had went to Pat Campbell's door. Margaret Campbell, his wife, answered the door, called Pat when these two men asked for Pat, and they shot him on his doorstep. Now, it was a very traumatic event, obviously, for his wife who'd seen this happening. Pat died on his way to the hospital. But what happened afterwards, a number of days afterwards, was that the police went to Margaret Campbell's house and asked her to go to an ID parade. She didn't have enough time to bring any family members. She was told to go alone. And if you can imagine, you know, from Bonbridge, it maybe would have taken maybe 35 minutes to get to the police station. She was in the back of the car alone. No one spoke a word to her. She's then put into an ID parade where she sees the man who had shot her husband just a number of days before. So after she was after she had pointed this person out, she was then told to go back in and touch the man who had shot her husband dead. Now, of course, how could a wife of after seeing her husband being killed go and touch the murderer even after she had already pointed this man out? So it was that level of shock, and for many people, it had shown that there was this duty of care which the police service should have to someone who had been through such a traumatic event, that wasn't there. There was no care given to that woman after her husband was killed.
Because
I think it's very, very important also to note that the man who had killed her husband was a police agent.
Because we're not talking about somebody who was high up in Sinn Féin. We're not talking about a man who was in the IRA. We're talking about a trade unionist, a man who went in to look after the interests of the workers. So you're not talking about somebody who you could possibly understand if he had been an IRA man, if he had been whatever, you know, in Long Kesh on hunger strike, whatever. You might understand that he would be seen as the enemy by the RUC or by the state forces. But that's not the case with this man. He had never done anything. He had never come to the attention of the police before, right?
Well, it's not only the case for Pat Campbell, it's the case for almost every single victim of the Glen Ann gang. They didn't target Republicans. The only Republican that they killed was a man called John Francis Green, and that was an accident. They went to kill someone else and kill John Francis Green accidentally. So they didn't target, this is, was the thing about the Glen Ann gang, they didn't target Republicans, they targeted moderate nationalists.
But why was that, Sean? Because there were so many people, I know I don't want to exaggerate, but there were so many people running around Belfast and Derry at that time who were hardline Republicans, who were dangerous men, who were in the IRA and the INLA. Why not go after them? Why go after these moderate Republicans who you actually might be able to make peace with?
I think it was to put the fear of God into the community. That, you know, this wasn't a war where those that were actively involved in it were being killed. Anybody, you know, it didn't matter who you were. If you just lived in a Catholic area, you were being targeted. So it was just to put the fear in the people. You know, it was really to put the fear in the people that to never even think about showing support for Republicans or the IRA.
So it's just pure sectarianism, basically. It was just ruled by fear.
Pure sectarianism, yeah.
When you were making the film, because obviously you interviewed many, many members of the families who were killed by the Glen Ann gang, I usually describe journalism as a process of verification. It's basically finding things out and then trying to, you know, as you say, you're trying to find the truth. Did you confront people from the RUC, the UDR, from the British state? Did you confront them with what you found out whilst making this film? And if so, what did they say about it?
Well, they never replied. I sent a letter to the MOD. And I also asked for a response for to two former chief constables who never responded to my requests.
Why do you think that they didn't respond? Is it because, if you know, are they opening Pandora's box by responding to you? Is it something that they would have better left unsaid and that, you know, let bygones be bygones kind of thing? Or do you think that, you know, they were trying in some way to sort of discredit the work that you were doing?
I think it's just better to say nothing. And I'm sure that there's a lot of information that these people had, which either they wouldn't like to have out in the public domain, or for reasons of the Official Secrets Act, just can't.
The response to the film, because it has been around for a couple of years, I think it was premiered in Belfast in 2018, if I remember rightly. And
and
it was recently shown then on the Irish Public Broadcaster on RTE.
I'd already done a world tour. It was, you know, it screened in Canada, America, and I went to Australia also with the film, and around Europe. And then, of course, the RTE screening was just last 16th of September, a couple of weeks ago.
So that's brought it up. We're talking just at the beginning of October here, and that has brought up, or it has sort of awakened the whole discussion around the Glen Ann gang as well. But one of the byproducts of this, and this always happens whenever a piece of work like this comes out, is that immediately certain people started to attack you and your credibility, and the fact that, you know, basically people were saying that you came from a Republican, from an IRA family, so of course you were going to make a film like that. What is your response to that?
Well, why... coming from a Republican family, can I not be a documentary maker? What's the reasons for that? Of course, we all have our baggage. It doesn't matter what side of the conflict that you come from. There shouldn't be any blockages, or there shouldn't be any determinations on what people can do. I mean, if you look at other politicians, or some loyalists, for example, look at maybe Emma Pengelly. Her father was a gun runner. She's now a DUP politician, a senior DUP politician, and I have absolutely no problem with that. But the thing is that this isn't really about me. What this is that it's about the change in narrative and the conflict. Who is going to tell stories from my community? Only people like me. And what happened is that unionists and, of course, the media in the South always had that control over the narrative. But the proliferation of digital and social media now has changed all that. And of course, we have young filmmakers, which, and young lawyers, young barristers, who are from a Republican persuasion. Now, I had conducted a survey in response to criticisms on my own work and the work that I'm involved in. And I looked back to between 1981 and 2005, when I record stopped on documentaries that were pro-state, for example. There were 674 documentaries on that list, which were pro-state, anti-Republican, pro-state, and I mean pro-British state. And when I conducted a survey on documentaries which may be considered anti-state, they were Shoot to Kill documentaries on Pat Finucane, etc. There were 22 against those 674 documentaries. Now, we've had three films, and if we count the Miami, recent Miami Show Band, we have had four films which could be considered anti-state in the sense that they are victim-centered films. They are not Republican films. The Glen Allen gang didn't attack Republicans. This was a gang that, for the most part, tried to kill members of the SDLP, a moderate nationalist party. This isn't a film about Republicans. As a matter of fact, the only time that the IRA are mentioned in On Quiet Graves is when we're dealing with the King's Mill massacre, when we had 10 Protestant workmen killed. So the criticisms on me being a filmmaker, and this is only the beginning of a campaign against me. We're going to see this up. The ante will be up when it comes to me. You'll find that they'll try to block funding for me. They will try to slur. Even we've had Charlie Flanagan try to throw ruses in about finance, also about John Weir, about the integrity of me. This is only the beginning of a campaign against me. It's because I'm a Republican, and I've seen it all before, and it won't waste, because I have scholarly, I've got the backing of Queen's University in this film. This isn't only 20-plus research that has went into the film through the Pat Finucane Centre and Justice for Forgotten. It's also part of a PhD project. I worked for 4 years on this, on my PhD also. So it's underpinned by scholarly research. And I have the backings of many, many leading academics in England, Wales, Scotland, and Ireland, and all over the world for that matter. So they can begin their attacks and they can begin their campaign against me. It won't waste.
You mentioned John Weir there, who's a kind of a central character in the film. And as far as I recall, John is a convicted murderer. So basically people were saying that he was an unreliable narrator, if we put it like that. But, you know, my question is, it's great to have, it's what he said in the film is very, very powerful. What he revealed to you in the film is very, very powerful. How did you find interviewing him? Did you find him credible? Is he, because again, it's one of those things that if something like that is put in front of us, we go, okay, I have to publish this. So maybe, you know, you might turn a blind eye. How did he strike you as a man? Did he strike you as repentant or credible, or how did you find
him? You see, you know, John Weir has had judicial scrutiny. So if it was just me going to interview John Weir and I hadn't got all those other things, I would never have used John Weir in the documentary. So first of all, we had John Weir being labelled as a credible witness by Judge Barron, okay, senior judge in Dublin. Also, the Gardaí who interviewed John Weir also said he was credible. This was also backed by two Oireachtas committees on John Weir and an international panel. That's before we even get to the substance of what John Weir said. So when John Weir had said within the film about the Catholic school that was to be attacked, that was also verified by a former RUC colleague of John Weir's, who's now dead, Billy McCaughey, who hadn't seen John Weir in years. So it's not as if they were trying to get each other's stories right. Mm-hmm. And a third source, which was a leading loyalist who's now alive in Belfast, told me only 3 years ago that the school attack was something that was going to happen. And he verified that also. So that's how I can take the credibility of John Weir when I add all those things together. If it was just me on my own going and taking that testimony of John Weir, I wouldn't have used it, you know?
In the case of John Weir, what he told you was that the Glen Allen gang was basically planning to attack a Catholic school and essentially provoke a civil war at the time. They're trying to provoke the IRA and drag them out into the open. So drag them out into basically, you know, extended street fighting. And that was sort of ruled out by many in the loyalist community as being a step too far, naturally enough, it has to be said. But that's basically what people in the Glen Allen gang, whom you made the film about, were considering. That's the level that they were operating at. What do you do now with this film? Because once you make a film like this, at some point, you know, you have to set it free. As you say, you've traveled the world with it, you've told the story, but now it's kind of come back. It's become part, like a major part of your life again over the last few weeks since it was broadcast by RTE. What's your relationship to the film now? And how long do you think it's going to be seen and discussed and part of the discourse around what happened with the Glen Allen gang?
Well, On Quiet Graves is only the beginning. We're already working on the follow-up to On Quiet Graves. So the second film will look at how the British policy had changed and how the assassination squads had changed their targeting Also, we're looking at the shoot to kill policies as a dual strategy to that which had happened against Republicans themselves. And this will lead up actually to the ceasefire in 1986, before the Good Friday Agreement. So UNCWAC Raise is only the beginning. It's a story that isn't finished. And we will be completing that film hopefully by next spring.
How do you see your role in the greater peace process? Because, you know, whether you're for or against the peace process, one way or another, this is going to have an effect. Some would accuse you of opening old wounds. Some think that it's brilliant that this information is coming out now because it gives a far more balanced picture of what happened during that time. How do you see your own role in that process and the effect that you have on it?
Well, I frame everything that I do within the process of conflict transformation. So what we have as part of the peace process now is legacy is the greatest issue and the greatest obstacle for peace. So the British government, they're still redacting documents. Documents are still going missing. There is no way that the British government is going to tell the truth. So what the families are left with is being able to engage with filmmakers and try to get the stories of their loved ones out there. So what we have, if we're looking at the future, is a mosaic of all these stories in the future. And what I'm determined to do is make sure that my own community and those who are affected by state murder have a say in that future.
What does this do to you, Sean? Because there's an emotional cost when you're creating something like this, when you have to sit and listen to these people, and when they cry in front of you and in front of your camera, and you have to ask them far tougher questions than I'd ever be able to ask you. How does that affect you personally?
I think I've been conditioned by the death of members of my own family. So I think that's the reason why I'm able to have such a relationship with people like Margaret Campbell and others, is that they can see that in me also. I'm not a journalist in the sense that I don't go in with leading questions. I just go in and ask people to talk about their loved ones. There's no leading questions at all. And we take the story from there. So I think there's that rapport that is built right away. And it just doesn't, I just don't go to someone's house. There's weeks and weeks of meeting these people beforehand and talking through things until they can earn their trust in me. We won't be bringing a single camera.
We're journalists, we're filmmakers, we're documentary makers, but we're also citizens. We also live in the communities and work in the communities that these things happened in. When you look around at that community today, one of the things that struck me, I brought a Swedish journalist friend of mine to Derry a few years ago, and we saw an awful lot of Derry, of the bog side of the city, of the history of it. And I found that it made me question an awful lot of my own knowledge, my own feelings towards that particular history. But I also found for the people in Derry, they were telling me that, you know, what there was not necessarily peace. It was more an absence of conflict. How would you describe the West Belfast that you live in today?
Well, that's a very good way of putting it. There's an absence of conflict. There certainly is, you know. And there's always this battle that is going on between those extremists and those that are still fighting for peace. And particularly in a place like West Belfast, that has been constant, right from the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, that's been constant. And I think the battle is won within local communities. I mean, I situate my work at grassroots in my local community. That's where my office is. That's where I'll always be, no matter what. And if we show our local community, if we put the work into our local community, we've always a chance of it never going back the way it was before.
One of the things that I've written about an awful lot in the last few years, actually since that trip to Derry, is the fact that I feel that I understand why the IRA existed. I don't condemn, like I don't condone, condemn, I don't get into the politics of that, but I understand how that could have happened, how that organization could have grown out of the situation that was there. What is happening on the street in West Belfast today? Because an awful lot of people who grew up, especially in the South during the 70s and the 80s, and they were reading certain newspapers and they were listening to the state broadcast and they were getting the state's feel, they are absolutely petrified of the IRA, Sean. Have they anything to be worried about from Republicans or dissident Republicans anymore, would you say?
Who are you speaking about, sir?
I'm speaking about people in the South, because they're the ones, when Sinn Féin started to get electoral success in the South, all of a sudden, like, the IRA is something that's thrown in their face. It doesn't matter. They could be talking about, you know, parental leave, and the IRA is brought up. They could be talking about social welfare. The IRA is brought up. And this is the thing. The IRA is the bogeyman. And what I'm asking you really is, do people have anything to fear from, or certainly people in the South, have they anything to fear from violent republicanism, or is that all a thing of the past now, would you say?
That's an old right-wing ruse about the IRA. The IRA is gone. The IRA is well gone. The IRA have manifested themselves in politics through Sinn Féin, and that's gone. We still see this in the South, and through ordinary people, the politically the culture down there has been shaped that unfortunately that people do see that every time that, you know, something something comes up. But the IRA are gone. It's Sinn Féin is a growing movement of activists, mostly young activists who, you know nothing of what happened before. And of course, you do have some of the older members of Sinn Féin who would have been ex-political activists, ex-IRA members. But listen, well, that was what the Good Friday Agreement was about. Mm. Manifest themselves in politics. Those days are gone. People don't need to be worried about the IRA because they're not there anymore. Mm. You know, we're the new generation now. So those issues have been dealt with. And you're going to continually see this from Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael to frighten people in the south. But people are beginning the ways up to that nonsense.
I've kind of seen that process happen over many years where people aren't listening to it because they don't remember that time, but B, you know, eventually it becomes irrelevant. Eventually you have to move on. You can't just keep talking about these things. But when I ask you, I'm not sure, we're not too far off one another in age, right? So I would have grown up in the 70s and 80s in Dublin, you in the 80s in Belfast. It's probably about 8 or 10 years between us. How do you feel about people like me from the South? When you look at the South, when you look at the way that the Republican nationalist community was more or less abandoned throughout the 70s and the 80s, it was people, you know, sort of looking at it going, no, that's nothing to do with us. You know, do you feel any sense of bitterness, any sense of resentment? Do you feel a frustration now at the way Northern Ireland is viewed by people in the South?
No, because I've a more of an educated view on it. And I don't mean to be pompous in saying that, you know, I know that the political landscape was shaped through censorship in the South. So I can't blame ordinary people for feeling like that. There was only one broadcaster, RTE, and everything that RTE had pumped out was politically shaped to cause apathy to what was happening in the North. So there's no way that I feel bitterness to anyone in the South. I understand how the media works. I understand how propaganda works. And that is the perfect example. If we look at how the broadcaster had shaped the conflict in the North, there was that abandonment. We can't blame people in the South. They didn't know anything else.
But at the same time now, because, I mean, you basically by telling this story, the Glenan gang, it has become, if you like, your full-time job to educate me and people like me. You know, you've done the emotional labor here. You've lost members of your own family to these gangs, and yet you still have to come and explain to us why all this happened. How long will you be able to do that? When will you run out of patience or energy for doing that? Because that's a rather large cross to bear, it has to be said.
This will always form my life's work. I'll never get sick of what I do in that sense. And if I do it with sensitivity, if I do it with compassion, I think I can get through to people. I mean, for the life of me, I don't understand how anyone can watch on Quack Graves and try and say that that's Republican propaganda. The people who are shouting that are the same people who haven't watched the program. I just don't understand how anybody can say that Unquiet Graves is Republican propaganda. What they mean is that it must be because it's made by someone who comes from a Republican family. But it's of course it's not Republican propaganda. It's victim-centered. It's about victims that were affected by the state.
If we look into the future, there's been an awful lot of talk of border polls, of the Good Friday Agreement, of reunification, all that. Very little of that actually interests me anymore, ever since that trip to Derry, where people talked about rather than peace and absence of conflict. Where do you see this going now? I mean, as I say, you're still on the ground. You're talking to people every day, to activists. You see what's happening at the grassroots level. What do you see in the future of Northern Ireland?
Well, I certainly see that the demographic, there's been a big shift in the demographic outlook after Brexit. I think it's hastened a united Ireland for sure. I think that we're looking definitely within the next 20 years of a complete reshaping of the island. I think whether that takes manifests itself in a kind of federal government or whatever else, Northern Ireland is finished. It never worked. It's a sectarian statelet. It always will be. There's no use talking about it, about trying to rehash it, trying to do this or that with it. It's a sectarian statelet that was formed and gerrymandered to suppress the nationalists in the North, and it can't be anything else. So when you try and work that state democratically, it falls apart. And that's exactly why we need to start talking about the reunification of the country. And of course, the unionist people in the North need to have their British identity copper fast and anything that happens. And I wouldn't want anything else which doesn't do that.
If I was to ask that same question of the lads that you didn't know, you were on one side of the riot in the 1980s, but you know, after that, fellas from the Shankill Road now that might be the same age as you, what would they answer to that question, do you think? How do they feel their future looks in Northern Ireland, would you say?
I think there's this denial of where we're going, and I just think that unionists won't deal with the possibility of a union Ireland that's coming very, very fast. So it's a kind of, there's no de Klerk. And that's very difficult to deal with when you have the kind of political ideology which is based on the words of no surrender, and whoever puts their head above the parapet is a Lundy. So there's never been leadership within the unionist community. It's just not there. And to be honest with you, they're walking into United Ireland without trying to come to some sort of better arrangement for unionism in the long run.
Would you say with Brexit now, I remember 2016 when the vote happened, I remember thinking exactly what you said there, that has just hastened the United Ireland, it's kind of made it inevitable. The unionist people, for all their loyalty to the union may very well abandon them to preserve what's on the mainland. Are they aware of that? Do you hear that in the community in West Belfast, on either side of the peace line, that possibility is there? Because that would be, you know, to me, that would be the ultimate betrayal, would be if the British government was to abandon the unionist community.
Listen, the unionists well know that the British government have bound up in sackets. Even at grassroots level, I speak to loyalists at a community level, and they say the same. But then when you try to engage about a way forward and the reunification of the country, which gives unionism a bigger say in a United Ireland than it would ever do within the current political settlement, they just don't want to talk about it, you know.
What are they afraid of then, Sean?
I to be quite truthful, It's a loss of privilege. It's a loss of supremacy. That's still embedded in their heads. They still think that they can keep crappies down. They think that they have the God-given right to the six counties in Ireland, and that Catholics should know their place. There's still that old sectarian ideology, which is hard to break.
Because when I look at the Shankill Road, they grew up... Those Protestant boys grew up in houses that looked exactly like your house. They went to shops that had exactly the same things on the shelves. So there was very little difference. And yet, of course, they still undeniably had privilege there. Does that privilege, other than in their own minds, does it still exist anymore in any way, would you say?
But it was the illusion of privilege when it came to the working class, you know. So what would happen is you'd have the unionist establishment would say to loyalists, you know, watch, they don't take what little you have from you, you know. So it was a cultural privilege, and it was this sense of supremacy. But they really didn't have much more than what we did. When it boiled down to it, they were just as poor as what we were on the Falls Road, you know.
And interestingly enough, it's that kind of rhetoric that actually sort of seems to have brought about Brexit when you talk about, you know, immigrants and foreigners coming to Britain and taking the little that you have. Just finally, and thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me, because as ever, it's been an education. But where, you mentioned that you have other films on the go now. What's next for you with the PhD? When can we next expect to see you do something like Unquiet Graves again?
Well, I finished the PhD. I have my doctorate.
It's done and all. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, so yeah, I just think I'm that busy with film now that I'll you know, for now and again, I do guest lectures. But the lecturing work for me is finished. I've just so much offers now around film. And I have a number of projects which is very close to my heart, which will take me well into the end of next year. I've also written a drama, which is based on an earlier short film that won an RTS award in 2016. So I'm just finessing that at the minute and want to get a film on that next year also. So I have a number of projects that's close to my heart, and I want to stay true to the grassroots stuff in my own community. It's about education for me, as you had mentioned earlier on, and I just want to give back to the community, educate younger people in film, and hopefully do something that can help in educating young Protestants too. I've been trying to make headway in contacts within the Shankill Road and getting young Protestants to get engage themselves in documentary also. But it's difficult because of a lot of the publicity around Unquiet Graves. We think that'll set that back for a number of months now, because when you have leading politicians in the South doing what they had done this week and trying to throw these ruses in and slur me and the work that I do, that has ramifications when you're trying to work with the opposite side of the community here, you know. So I hope that we can make headway on that in the next few months.
Last question. If somebody on the West Coast of America in Hollywood is listening to this and they had an unlimited budget to give Sean to make a film, what film would you make tomorrow if you had unlimited money?
What film would I make tomorrow? I'll make a very, very good job of the second film on Quiet Graves, put it that way.
There's plenty of stories left to be told. Thank you very much for talking to me, Sean.
Thanks very much. All right.